This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Guest today, we are here with Major James Villanueva, PhD, Ohio State. Major Villanueva, welcome.
Thank you.
And among many things, you are doing research on Army amphibious operations, which to many of our listeners may sound kind of like a contradiction. So let's start at kind of the very, very basic level. When we think about the military, when we think about what we refer to now as, you know, joint operations, joint forces, amphibious operations seem like something the Marine Corps should be doing. So why, in World War II broadly, both Atlantic and Pacific, why is the Army involved in something that seems like a Marine job?
Well, Emil, I think that's due to a number of factors. One, the Marine Corps is just not big enough to do all the operations that we're conducting. There are only six divisions over the course of the war. Obviously, there are about 89 Army divisions, depending on how you want to count them. No Bill be able to talk about that, but so there are just too many missions for the Marine Corps to take every single amphibious operation. Additionally, the Marine Corps is generally trained for based its doctrine around opposed amphibious landings, so we want to use them for that. When we're doing unopposed landings that often the Army conducts, better to, you know, economy of force and other reasons to use the Army.
So let's walk through kind of very basically what we mean by amphibious operations. You mentioned that there's kind of this dichotomy between opposed and unopposed landings. So are we talking just, you know, landing ships roll up on a beach? What all's involved in this?
And that really, unfortunately, it depends, I guess, is METTC dependent, as the Army, the military folks like to say. But sometimes it's seizure of a port, for example. So you're not don't necessarily need the specialized landing ships, depending on what you're doing if the port already exists. Other times, you know, you're seizing a beachhead against that's defended, so you'll need to do an actual assault with lots of firepower, and large numbers of troops. Other times, you're doing some basically an infiltration with smaller units or even larger units, but it's unopposed and whether or not a beach is there will determine the kinds of vessels that you're using.
So what's the relationship here between, again, the Marines are off doing Marine things. So basically we're talking Army-Navy, correct?
In most cases, yes. But especially early on in the war, when there's the Navy's just not big enough to support all the Army's operations, especially in the Southwest Pacific. Plus you have the perhaps inter-service rivalries or trepidations of the Navy in the Southwest Pacific with giving Douglas MacArthur an Army commander their ships, essentially. Sometimes these landings are what we call shore-to-shore operations where Army amphibious vessels, often from the engineer special brigades, go onto a beach, pick up an Army unit, and then drop them off in the same vessels. So it's not a ship-to-shore operation.
So, interestingly, what you're talking about is the Army's Navy, not the Navy's Navy. So, we got lots of layers of complication here.
Okay, so let's kind of start putting our hands around some of the command structure. So you talked about MacArthur, we talked about the Navy. So let's talk about how are these organizations commanded, who's directing the landings, and because we're talking two different cabinet-level departments, right? The Department of the Navy and the War Department. So how are the who's commanding these operations and how are they being put together?
So this is another case where, again, it depends, right? So the Central Pacific, that's generally a Navy show under Admiral Nimitz. If there are Army forces involved there, there's essentially an Army force provider, what we would kind of call an ASCC. I wouldn't call it exactly that, but
For our listeners, what's an ASCC?
Army Service Component Command.
Okay.
So, for example, the 27th Infantry Division, New York National Guard, if I recall correctly, they support marine operations in the Gilberts and also in the Marianas. But that's under a Marine Corps commander as far as the ground force commander. Typically, when the Army or Marine units are aboard ship, they fall under Navy command.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Central Pacific, Nimitz. So he has Army divisions serving underneath his overall theater command. And then at that point, a division of that from that command would then contribute some forces to a landing operation.
Yes.
Okay.
So let's talk about the other major commands. So, and for people who are unaware, there are technically six Allied commands in the Indian and Pacific Oceans. We're not worried about the Indian one. We're not worried about the Chinese one. So there are three Navy commands across the Pacific. Let's just pretend those are under Nimitz. And then we have the fly in the ointment, as is often the case in these operations, Douglas MacArthur. So how does this work in the South Pacific with more of the bigger islands? We talked through the Navy part. How does it work in the Army part?
Right. So in the South Pacific, MacArthur's never actually officially, in command of Navy forces completely. He's essentially given, the Third Fleet for certain operations. For example, during Operation Cartwheel, Halsey's Third Fleet is reporting to him, but he doesn't necessarily have, what we legally call complete command control over,
So the doctrines might be something like TACON, tactical control.
Exactly, right.
Mm. Which is, he can direct where it goes, but he doesn't get to do anything else with them.
Exactly. And that's generally how it works if MacArthur is given any kind of naval forces. Often he is not. So in that case, he has to, use the engineer special brigades or maybe he's only given some aircraft carriers but no amphibious vessels. So it really depends on what operation they're doing. By the time we get to the Philippines, though, there are the Central Pacific is cooperating heavily with MacArthur's forces. So generally, though, the way, and Kevin Holzimer has a good article on this, but generally the way MacArthur allows joint operations to unfold in his theater is they're all cooperative. He doesn't appoint, the air component commanders in charge of the other services. It's kind of just a meeting of equals, essentially, for a given operation.
Hmm. Interesting. So let's, we've kind of got the strategic overview, and one question for people who may be familiar with more modern type structures, this is for both of you. We now have things called combatant commands. They're built into law. You have a general or admiral in charge of a combatant command. How does that compare to a World War II theater?
I guess I'll start from there. It's in the modern era, if we were to do this, it would be, if we were to do an amphibious operation, pick New Guinea. I don't know why we would be in New Guinea, but let's do the one for one with World War II. Is that whoever is the commander of Indo-PACOM, which is the four-star headquarters, which spans basically half the globe, he would probably appoint a joint forces commander. It's not a big enough operation where he himself would take personal command of the operation. That joint forces commander for an amphibious operation would probably be a Navy guy. Maybe a Marine, but we'll just say Navy. And at that point, he will give that Navy commander, or he will give that joint forces commander, Navy assets, some sort of ground asset, whether that's a Marine or an Army component. In the modern day and age, it will probably be a Marine component, Bill Nance's opinion. And then he will give that guy some air assets as well. Now, that might be the carrier, but it might also be some Air Force assets as well. And the Army component would probably be some sort of air-landed or airborne operation in terms of that. So he would basically create this package, give this to the Joint Forces Commander, and then kind of get out of this guy's way to land the operation. Over to you.
Yeah. So that the kind of contrast that certainly could actually contrast with, we'll just say, Southwest Pacific area, and given operation in New Guinea. So Nassau Bay is one of the earliest ones down there. So that's a very interesting case study because the Australians are already on the ground in the area that we're doing this amphibious operation. It ends up being a regimental combat team operation minus, at least initially. overall command, I guess we would say, would go to the regimental commander, Colonel McKechnie. But he's given a few amphibious craft, about 30 from one of the engineer special brigades, and then he's given three PT boats to escort them. But the PT boats are also carrying some of his soldiers, so they're going to have to do a transfer in there at some point.
So this is Army Landing Force on Army ships, or
right.
I don't know
boats,
if you want to call
I guess.
An LSD
boats,
a ship.
Right,
but,
yes.
But so Army soldiers on Army ships, and the PT boats are actually Navy assets, right?
Exactly.
But they're under his direct command.
I guess so. I'm sure they have basically, and it's not completely clear, at least from the documents I've seen, but I'm sure they have right of refusal if he decides to do something crazy with them, like tell them to go attack a destroyer. I don't think that's necessarily going to happen.
Am I understanding correctly that because of laws passed in the 1980s, we take things like who controls what units and the whole rank structure and org chart, we take that more formally and seriously than they might have in the early 1940s.
Absolutely.
Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, I would say that. It's definitely less formal. But on top of that, his regimental combat team is going to fall under, I think it's the Australian 5th or 7th Division when they get on shore. So it's also a combined operation. It happens in rain. It doesn't go very well. The boats are broached, and a bunch of them can't actually be serviceable. And his third wave doesn't even make it, which is fortunate because they need that third wave to actually bring supplies to them. So I think that's just one example. Smaller unit ends up having his other two battalions brought in, but those are put under a separate command, a separate U.S. Army commander, but also reporting to the Australians. So
one of the big controversies in naval landings, particularly with Torch and being kind of the first one, is, now of course I know I'm flipping sides of the world on you, but you can
sure,
go back
of course,
to the Pacific.
I got you. Yeah.
but the idea being is who commands when? Because the Navy commander obviously wants to maneuver and operate his ships because he is...
And planes.
But he's going to handle his stuff because he is the subject matter expert on that or on that equipment in that organization.
Let's also not forget, unlike modern warfare for the most part, naval gunfire is very important in this conflict.
So, but then when you land... The Army guy is, of course, going to take over, but there's this weird middle ground where the Navy stuff is dumping the Army guys off. Now, in the case you mentioned, it sounds like the Army guy owned all of it. Is that the case in other cases, or how do they do that?
Well, let's take this from the beginning. That's a really good question, and I'd like to kind of unspool it from the beginning. When you think about the subject we've talked a lot about, Dr. Nance and I, the interwar years military, I can't imagine they would have spent a lot of time thinking about or practicing this stuff, writing doctrine for it, requisitioning equipment for it. Is that true? Were we thinking about amphibious operations outside the Marine Corps in the interwar years?
So the Army does a number of small-scale exercises with the Marine Corps, but it really is the Marine Corps that's the one that's developing the doctrine, especially with a focus on opposed landings,
right,
which are certainly more complex.
Right. So in terms of the training as well, too, I can't imagine we're doing things like division-level training exercises with amphibious operations in the Army.
I think the first and the third do, but again, they're very limited. I haven't seen a lot on like lessons that were perpetuated around the Army.
So like so many things in this war, we're kind of making it up as we go along, right?
And the doctrines, what's interesting is, because you said the Marines wrote the doctrine,
right,
and that makes sense, right? In the joint force, the Marines are going to do most of the thing, they're going to do the doctrine.
Yeah, they do Marine things.
Yes. So the problem is what are the challenges in taking Marine Corps doctrine and applying it to Army formations? Because the Marines, of course, are in the Department of the Navy. They all kind of know each other, sort of. but as opposed to the Army now suddenly plugging into using this.
Right. Well, its force structure is a problem. I think, is it Kurtol's book?
Yes.
I just read in there, the Navy essentially for the amphibious divisions that were going to go to Europe, I think, the Navy was pushing to have them restructured so they would better fit Navy practices. The Army wasn't very happy about that, obviously.
Because they have to fight once they get off the ship.
Right, exactly.
Right?
So there's that. You know, the Marines, often their units are larger than equivalent Army units, so you'd have to fill in some gaps there. You know, some of the equipment's definitely different as well, depending on what it is. So,
So let me ask both of you to put your tactics hats on. You have a landing place. Let's just say it's a beach. You are required to move large army units onto and then away from the beach on land. You've got them on ships. You know, Navy's doing Navy things. You have air cover, whether or not it's contested. What are the issues and challenges that you have to solve to accomplish this mission, kind of on the tactical level?
So think of it like you're loading up a van, if that makes sense, right? So you're moving your house, and you put all your stuff into this van, and then the van comes, and then the mover, you pay the movers, and the movers drop all of your stuff in the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
Great. All my stuff's here. What goes into the house first? You only have so much lift capacity.
All right, I'm gonna be dumb civilian. Why don't we just send the guys with rifles first?
Okay, you can, and the guys with rifles come first. The problem then comes into the guys with rifles get hurt, they get hungry, they want ammunition, they might need some support. All these things have to come, like artillery is a for instance. Engineers, as one thing we've all come to appreciate is the world that does not have nearly enough combat engineers. Or you talked about special engineers. I want to come back to that.
Yes.
But those are the challenges you're facing from the tactics perspective of doing all of this. Now, the other problem, and Jim, I want you to really touch on this, is you are depending upon someone who you don't fully control to bring you the rest of your stuff. Can you hit that piece?
Yeah, absolutely. So so on top of that, there's minor issues that can become major issues, right? So for example, Vela, in that case, and you know, to say these are different, this is also a regimental combat team landing, but it's in the South Pacific, which is, you know, mostly a Navy theater. It's with the regular 35th Infantry Regiment of the 25th Infantry Division. In that case, they created a task force under the Assistant Division Commander of the 25th, Robert McClure. So it's not the regimental combat team commander who's in charge of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's in Navy ships, so there's a transfer from the ocean-going ships to the amphibious ships, so that occurs. But they really hadn't figured out how they wanted to manage beachhead operations specifically. There weren't really any units focused on those. Interestingly as well, there are Marines in this operation, but they're from one of the defense battalions, so they're mostly air defense units. So.
Yeah.
But it's also going to be, they also anticipate they're going to receive enemy aircraft, so you've got to figure out where to put this anti-aircraft unit, for one, to defend your beachhead. But the supplies, kind of like Bill was talking about, are all just dumped on the beach in very haphazard fashion. None of the supply folks can figure out where anything is for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And in the after action report, I even saw they said they needed MPs to be on the beach from now on. Why? Because a lot of the soldiers' barracks bags were dumped on the beach, and a lot of them were pilfered of various and sundry either army or personal equipment. So
remember, there's only one thief in the army.
Of course. So that's an issue. And then how are you moving, even if those are organized on the beachhead in a coherent manner, how are you moving it forward then? Another one of the landings I could talk about in New Guinea, actually, there are no roads inland from the beach. So you have to have engineers with you to carve out roads through the jungle, or you're going to have to hand carry a lot of these things, which at Nassau Bay, the earlier operation I talked about, they talked about having a certain number of porters, I think it's about 120 per battalion, mm-hmm. just of local people to carry equipment forward into the jungle.
So we've been talking about the tactical stuff, which right. is the stuff we brought with us, and we've landed on the beach, and we now have our stuff, however disorganized it might be.
Right.
And for those of you that have ever moved and you've lived in boxes, you know what that's like. But I wanted to. But can you hit a little bit more on what happens after this stuff you brought with you is used up, or you need more? How is that coming? How is that all that stuff and things coming from some other port to my beach to get me what I need.
Right. Well, if you looked at the Army doctrine, it would tell you, at least for as a regimental combat team, you would then just tell your division you needed these items. But as you can see in these cases, the division headquarters isn't even with these regimental combat teams. So you'd probably have to relay through radio of any Navy vessels that are remaining offshore that you need something. Or if, you know, there's now an established Army garrison headquarters essentially on ashore, they could probably radio for those supplies. But it's, to answer your question, Bill, it kind of depends because there's no real, like, doctrinal check sheet on how you're going to be doing these things.
An important point I think that's worth talking about, too, is especially early in the war, most of the examples we've been talking about, I think, are from 43.
Yes.
So fairly early. In the best of times, in an exercise, this stuff is difficult. In this war, every domain is contested. We don't control the air, we don't control the sea, and of course we don't control the land. That's the point of the operation. So what degree of difficulty does it add when especially we don't control the sea, but also the air?
So Vella Lavella is a perfect case. There's actually a naval battle of Vella Lavella besides the the army operation. So a lot of times the escorts end up having to pull off or protect, you know, the transport vessels, whether they be Army or Navy. And they therefore can't do things like you talked about, naval gunfire support, which until you get your artillery ashore, that's how you're doing most of your fire support unless you have aircraft, which you also might not necessarily have aircraft, or that might be a contested domain. So, it certainly makes it difficult. And if the Navy commander is worried about the threat to his ships, as happened off Guadalcanal, which is mostly a marine operation, you know, you might not even get any kind of resupply or Navy support for quite a while. It might not be persistent. It's going to be episodic is what I'd call it, which are not non-doctrinal terms, of course, but that's really how I'd...
Yeah.
So the guys are coming ashore. So I've got all these guys. Now, this is... We might laugh and say, but the Army has to train how to load people onto trucks.
Right.
And we laugh until you've ever seen a large group of people try and load buses all at the same time,
yes, right?
Right. There's actually some training that goes into this. Is this part of these units' normal training regimen? And how does that kind of play into how these Army units are now doing amphibious things?
Right. So, again, unfortunately, Bill, it depends. So I think
hopefully our listeners are understanding why we all laughed when we originally said MET-TC, because it means it depends.
Right. For example, the 41st Infantry Division, of which the 162nd, which conducts the Nassau Bay operation, is a part, doesn't do formal amphibious training with the Australian-based Amphibious Training Center until after the landing at Nassau Bay has occurred. In another example, the 158th Regimental Combat Team, which is an independent regimental combat team, it conducts landings at Noumfor and in the southern part of Luzon. So those are in 44 and 45. Mm-hmm. As far as I've seen, they never conducted any form of formal amphibious training ever at any of these amphibious training centers. All this to say, kind of similar to a lot of the Army training that we do, you don't necessarily get the training before you need it. At least in the Pacific theater. I'd say that's due to a number of factors. Often it's because MacArthur is pushing units into operations as quickly as he can, because he's keeping a very rapid pace of operations, and it's outpacing what he had either told the Joint Chiefs or the Combined Chiefs that he was doing, or opportunities present themselves. While a lot of units come through there, and just in 1943 alone, the Australian training centers that were, U.S. and Australian, trained the 1st Cavalry Division, the 24th Infantry Division, the 32nd, the 41st, and two of the Australian divisions. So there's a lot of throughput at these places for what it is, but another example, the 37th Infantry Division gets its amphibious training in 1944, after which it's already done the Bougainville operation. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, training it is good, but is there an attempt to do vicarious learning, as in lessons learned, training circulars? Is that at least making its way through the force?
Some, but it's uneven, as you'd imagine, because... Not everyone's always able to read everything all the time, and it often depends. So I'll go back to the Nassau Bay example. So Colonel McKechnie actually writes out fairly extensive notes after that operation. And one of the things he says was, well, we did know, this is our first operation. We tried to learn what we could. So we looked at the current, you know, TTPs or ARs, et cetera, from operations at Bunagona, which had happened, previously on New Guinea, as well as the British fighting the Japanese in Malaya, which you'd think would be useful. He said they were not useful at all, or only moderately useful. Why? Well, the terrain was different, so he's attacking against ridgelines, horizontal. In at Bunagona, it's in the coastal plain essentially, so it's not the Japanese aren't dug in the same manner, right? And then Malaya, the British are on the defensive, so that didn't necessarily help them either as far as a lot of those TTPs.
Before we go any further, I have a dumb question. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have. You keep saying regimental combat teams instead of regiments. So, Dr. Nance, World War II force management expert, what is a regimental combat team?
A regiment is a group of it's a pure infantry regiment. It's typically three battalions of infantry with three battalions of a regiment has three battalions of three companies. Typically, there might be an assault like a cannon company or something attached. But for our purposes, nine companies of infantry plus some assorted organic assets. When you add in additional enablers, that's when you get into a regimental combat team. Interesting enough, we still keep that, we call it BCTs. That name is thrown around a lot. It stands for Brigade Combat Team. Mm-hmm. What it consists of is a series of additional enablers added into that organization to give it more capability than just the pure organic nine companies of infantry plus some cannons. So now they've got might have infantry, they might have a company of tanks, they might have some air defense assets, they might have some engineers. There's no one size fits all look of what an RCT is, because it is designed to be custom designed for the operation it's going to look like.
So if I'm understanding correctly, the regiment, to borrow Clausewitz's terms, is war on paper. And the RCT is war in reality.
Right. There are very few times in World War II where you will just see a pure regiment by itself fighting. They do exist, but the airborne is actually one of those cases where you see that. But even them, they often have assets tagged in as they go through there.
So let's pull on that thread, because I want to circle back to something, Dr. Villanueva, you've said a couple times now. It sounds like there's a linchpin to how all of this works. You know, infantry, if you need to, they can get themselves ashore, right? Infantrymen can swim. Tanks don't
That's
swim.
That's a bold assumption, well, yes.
Tanks don't swim. 155 doesn't swim. Packs of, you know, ammo, food, equipment doesn't swim. Planes, for the most part, don't swim. So pretty much everything requires you to build and maintain the infrastructure and the systems to get them there and get them through the landing. So talk to us about these engineer units you've referenced a couple times. Who are they? Where are they from? What do they do?
Okay, yeah. So the engineer special brigades, I think there ends up being six of them over the course of the war, if I'm not mistaken, Bill. Built around these engineer boat and shore regiments, which are exactly what you think they would be. So it's a lot of amphibious vessels, so the landing craft vehicle personnel, the LCVP, and the landing craft mechanized, basically to carry tanks or other troops, as it were. They're organized to do that for generally Army units and conduct either, like I mentioned, a shore-to-shore operation, moving the from one beach to another, or, you know, actually sailing on Navy vessels and then bringing Army units ashore. They also, though, have maintenance units for all those boats, and then supply and service units. And very importantly, they also have essentially units that are designated to perform shore party operations. That's the stuff that I kind of alluded to with traffic management on the beach. Who's designating what areas are for what supplies and who goes where, right? Who's directing where the ships offload, right? And then who's directing how those things move forward? So basically at the intersection between the water and the land, they fulfill that purpose of managing that. You also have Navy beach parties, which perform kind of the same operation, but you don't necessarily have enough Navy beach parties and or ESBs to be everywhere all at once. So maybe it's a combination of those things, maybe not.
Now, so when you get Navy beach parties and an engineer special brigade, there is some sort of command structure, like right. There's one person in charge of the beach?
Yes. Ideally, yes.
So let's pull that thread, too, because I think that's another interesting one. This sounds like it's chaotic, particularly if the sea and air domains are contested. So what kind of leadership do you need on that beach, whether it's the infantry commander moving forward or the engineer commander directing traffic and getting ships on shore and cutting roads?
So you need someone focused on the beach. And that's why, in that case I talked about, Vella, the regimental commander is focused on flooding his regiment. And what I mean is he's focused on the maneuver, the fire support, everything of making sure that regiment is moving forward and achieving its objectives on land, right? Mm-hmm. General McClure's job essentially was, and really didn't see it stated in the documents, but he's in charge of the overall operation, so the interface with the Navy, but also they're supposed to be building an airfield, so he's overseeing that. He's ensuring that everything's moving from the beach and that the regimental combat team is getting what it needs, and also ensuring troops are disciplined enough to huddle on the beach. Why? Well, the Japanese actually attacked, launched, I think 120, 150 air raids against both the Navy and land forces there. I think the Marine Defense Regiment, who's managing that as well with their anti-aircraft units, obviously that should fall under McClure. So there's a lot of other things besides just the ground combat or the Navy combat.
So what you're getting at is that the stuff that we often read most of the books about and is the cool stuff, the stuff they make the movies about, mm-hmm. is the dudes splashing ashore with a rifle and all that kind of stuff.
Saving Private Ryan.
But really what you're getting at is the thing that makes us successful is all that infrastructure behind that soldier to keep that soldier or his replacement in the fight as long as humanly possible. Right. Did I get
that's,
that?
That's absolutely right. Yes, ma'am.
So are these infantrymen, we'll kind of start at the tip of the spear, are the infantry going ashore first and creating the bridgehead and expanding it? Do they get any kind of special training for amphibious or Pacific warfare, or are they just straight off the assembly line?
Again, depends. So I think I mentioned those units that had come through the Amphibious Training Center. They certainly are getting that training. Another example would be the 81st, which I would say it actually does work out probably how the Army intended. So the 81st Infantry Division actually conducts extensive amphibious training with the Navy in California, I believe, and then they do more in Hawaii. They're finally employed in the Palaus on Peleliu. They're also employed to conduct an unopposed landing to seize a major fleet anchorage at Ulithi. Mm.
Are they retraining? Because these units take casualties.
Oh, sure.
Or they get non-battle casualties, right. All that kind of stuff. Are they ever going back and at a certain point where they've taken so many casualties, so we're going to go back and basically retrain them in this skill set?
No, generally, from what I've seen, I think only, if I recall, the 9th Australian Division of the ones I've seen on the list, at least in the Southwest Pacific area, it goes through twice, the amphibious training. Otherwise, they're relying on rehearsals. So that's the other way you can kind of shortcut this. So if you don't have time for the formal training at one of the training centers, if you do extensive rehearsals, generally you can mitigate some of the problems you're having. I forget which operation it was. In one case, I think it's the Palawan operation, if I'm not mistaken, in the Philippines. But the Navy and the Army had different ideas on which waves were going ashore first. Luckily, they caught that in the rehearsal, so the waves were able to be ordered in the way that the Army thought best to achieve the mission ashore. But
So for people who are unaware, and this surprised me the first time I saw one, what is an Army rehearsal? What does it look like? What are you doing?
Right. We have different kinds of rehearsals, but you're doing a number of things. So you're, one, ensuring everyone knows what their role is. Two, you're ensuring things are synchronized in time and space. So you're actually at a combined arms rehearsal, generally that's over some kind of terrain model.
Which people would be shocked to know, even in the 2020s, might be yarn and tape on a floor.
Right, yep, and often is. Sometimes you'll have Christmas lights if you want to do a river or something. But, and then subordinate units, it's attended by all the major units, and then everyone talks through in time and space what they're supposed to be doing, at least the way it's supposed to work. It's supposed to happen on the map, and they move the unit icons as if they would be moving. And it, you all, you, a good one will also incorporate contingencies. So if the plan has to change, you know, what if this happens? Well, this is what we're going to do.
Are they actually doing the full up dress rehearsals like we saw at Slapton Sands, and there where guys are actually getting on boats, landing on beaches, coming ashore?
Right. Some are, but some either don't have the time or they're experienced enough to not feel the need for a rehearsal necessarily. So
we talked about the so that's the combat units. Right.
So what about, you mentioned there might be a tank company, artillery, air defenders. Are they rehearsing the same way? Are they?
No, not necessarily. So I'll bring up another, probably one of the most complex, I'd argue, amphibious operations of the war. And it's actually only conducted by a battalion, but that's because the main ground forces are going to be provided by the 503rd Airborne Parachute Regimental Combat Team. That's the Corregidor operation in Manila Bay.
And for clarity, this is the return to Corregidor?
Yes.
So the U.S. forces are pushed off of Corregidor in 42. This right. is return in...
Yes, 45. So
45.
February of
1945.
Okay. That one, the 503rd is going to be coming from, I believe it's Mindoro, so an island south of Luzon. Their amphibious force, which is landing on the south side of the island, is from the 34th Infantry Regiment. It's one battalion, but they're on Bataan Peninsula, which is just to the north of Corregidor. I believe the tank units are also coming from there. But if you'd imagine, once the paratroopers get on the ground, they're going to have to work with the tanks. But because they're on different islands, there's no rehearsal. But they're not going to move the tanks or the parachute infantry regiment
right.
up to one of those places to do the rehearsal.
Right.
The AAR actually said that the 503 needs to... you know, work with tank units better.
And our
in the
armor
future.
Officer, Dr. Nance, is smiling.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so, Jimmy, you're an infantryman by trade,
yes.
right? So it's like, it's the problem is that if you don't train for it, the tank, like an infantryman will come and pound on your tank and you can't hear them. So just that becomes a problem of not running over the infantrymen
right,
and the infantrymen having the tanks shoot where they need them to shoot.
Yes, especially on a small island like that. But it, yeah, I think they do put telephones on some of the Shermans eventually, right?
The telephones, but also just learning how to talk to a guy on the other end because he can't see where you're pointing if you're on a telephone.
Exactly.
And tankers train for this, but it's just the, you know, understanding what the other one's seeing, what they can do, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Which is why now we do a lot of cross-training and training people in different specialties once they get to a certain level. But, of course, this is an army thrown together via conscription, so they don't really have the time to do all this.
So we talked about the we talked about the infantry, we talked about the attachments. Let's talk about the sustainers. How are the sustainers training this? Are they training?
I'd have to, you know, look at the documents in even more detail, but they're just doing rehearsals like everyone else. A lot of it focuses on the load plans, right? So mm-hmm. what supplies are we putting on what boats at what time? When is the stuff due in? Mm-hmm. But it seems like, at least for the sustainers, there's a lot of seat of your pants kind of.
Mm-hmm. So to use a term that is back in vogue within the United States Army, we're learning in contact.
Yes. Absolutely.
So do we see learning occur?
And that
across
that's
there?
What I'll say is probably most important if to get from all of this is that's what these units are doing, right? The 503rd's never really worked with tanks extensively before Corregidor, but they managed to make it work, and they do need those tanks to destroy some of those built-up bunkers on Corregidor. Same with the 158th, right? Like I said, they never received formal amphibious training. Obviously, there's been crosstalk. The Navy units they're doing these operations with have done the amphibious operations, so obviously there's some sharing of tactics, techniques, and procedures there. But yeah, there's plenty of figuring it out as you're as you're going.
So let's talk about the linchpin organization. These engineers, are they just trained as engineers, or do they have special training in, you know, engineering in the tropics, which rots everything, or amphibious engineering, or do we just again throw them in and expect them to figure it out?
I'd say it's a little bit of both. Some of them do acclimation, or you know, they're in areas of Australia where they're seeing some of these problems. But yeah, not necessarily, because it's, like I said, so uneven. You're not necessarily going to get all the training you think you would need or that the Army would want you to have before you're going into these operations. So
yeah, and something else that the engineers are involved in that you mentioned earlier that I'd like to talk about. So we've kind of laid out a pattern where you land, you build your beachhead. You send your RCT forward maybe to expand the beachhead. But one of the really important things that a lot of people don't understand about the Pacific is we think of aircraft carriers, and that's our air power. But the majority of air power in the Pacific was land-based. So talk about the role that airfields, particularly building new airfields, plays in a lot of these operations.
Right. And that's absolutely... basically the reason for doing a lot of these operations. Vela Vela, you're putting an airfield where you need it, so to essentially increase the operational reach so you can attack somewhere else. You know, same with like the reckless and persecution operations, which were essentially a turning movement to move the to get, I think, about 200 miles behind the Japanese 18th Army on New Guinea. You're building a bunch of airfields there to support follow-on operations. And in a number of cases, too, for example, Bunagona, they end up having to bring a lot of the reinforcements up over the Owen Stanley Range via air because it's so treacherous to march forces around, and they don't necessarily have the shipping to sail troops around to that side of the north side of the island from south where a lot of the Allied troops are.
So these guys are not just engineers. There might be a pot. Everyone kind of has a different idea of engineers. Like Dr. Abel has a guy with a mallet and maybe a
copper pontoon boat.
Copper pontoon and all that kind of stuff. Some of them might think of a guy running forward with a Bangalore torpedo. But these guys are really kind of doing it all, right? Because to build an airfield is some horizontal construction, and then also building all the fuel and all that kind of stuff. So when we're talking about these engineer brigades, these are very capable organizations.
Yes. Now, generally, the engineer special brigade is not building an airfield. We're fortunate we have a lot of airfields specific engineers, so either the SEAT and the Navy Seabees, the construction battalions, or in the case of the persecution operation on New Guinea at Itape, that's actually an Australian airfield.
So what you're getting at is that... It's not just the combat arms that is combined and joined.
Right.
Where you're talking the sustainment and the administrative, for lack of a better term, is combined and joint, where we're pulling capabilities from across the combined and joint force to get the job done.
Right. Exactly.
So let's put on our Japanese hat. It's an uncomfortable hat, but let's put on our Japanese hat for a minute. We kind of talked through the process of how this works from the American perspective, how you do these landings, opposed or unopposed, how, you know, kind of how all that works. So if you're the Japanese, if you're defending against these, what are your tasks? What are your concerns? How do you go about doing this?
So initially, Tarawa's probably the best example. The Japanese think they can defeat the amphibious operation at the beach. They eventually figure out that no matter how strong their defenses, Allied firepower and Allied force ratios are so overwhelming that they can't defend at the beach. So eventually, they'll adopt defense in depth on a lot of these islands.
So yeah. we're moving from Tarawa, where a whole lot of Marines die on the beaches, to like Okinawa, where you have to go through every square foot of the island to
Absolutely.
Get the Japanese out.
Right. I think John McManus talks about this. Do you necessarily need to do that? I don't know. But so
if you're the Japanese, why are you doing that? Why are you building these elaborate cave systems that you're forcing the Americans to fight you through?
Right. Well, part of it, you're trying to destroy American will, right? So the more casualties you cause to the Americans, the more costly you make to make it to conduct these assaults, perhaps the Americans will tire of the war and then end it. Also, Okinawa and some of the other islands, you're trying to buy time for and tie down American forces to allow the home islands to prepare for what's anticipated to be a ground invasion of the home islands. So that's two of the reasons there. Plus, you're also preserving your force structure. So because American firepower is so overwhelming by, you know, probably summer of 1944, certainly in 1945, if you're essentially identifying yourself by engaging American forces on the beach or allowing them to see you on the beaches in these defensive positions, you're probably going to get destroyed. Mm-hmm. So
what about at sea? If you're a Japanese captain or admiral, how do you approach these operations? As you say, the Americans have numerical superiority, although early in the war, not yet qualitative superiority. So how do you go about contesting these landings from the sea?
It's certainly difficult. By 1944, Battle of Leyte Gulf, it's going to be incredibly difficult for you to even get in to oppose the Americans from your bases, right? Mm-hmm. But it really probably you're using submarines or some kind of stealthy attack craft or any kind of suicide vessels. But really, you have to get through the Navy covering force that's securing the logistical or other fleet units in order to actually affect the beachhead. That, or you're trying to use aircraft to attack the beachhead directly, which they do.
Which is why you have all those marine air defenders that you talked about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you were talking about, because in the Pacific, we have all this stuff, right? It's an amazing array of stuff when you actually look at the Big Iron Mountain. But of course, the challenge, of course, is your stuff does you no good sitting at what we might call your ISB, your intermediate staging base. You have to actually put it where you need to be. So, which is where these amphibious assaults come in. How many of these are actually conducted?
So just an example, in the southern Philippines, in 1945, the 8th Army conducts 38 landings in 44 days. So,
and that is one small part, or one part of one campaign.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out, as I understand it, these are not all Okinawa or Taro, right? A lot of these are, as you said, shore unopposed.
Right, exactly. And that's what's really struck me. So Palawan's a perfect example. So that's one regimental combat team of the 41st Infantry Division. The other two regimental combat teams of that division are also conducting a separate landing at on Mindanao with the division headquarters. So it's a separate regimental combat team on its own attacking this very long island in the Philippines. I believe it's like 90 miles long or something like that.
It's the really long, skinny one.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. Right. But they also conduct battalion and company size landings on about 10 islands, 5 to 10 islands offshore as well over the course of that operation.
So how does this work from a command and control perspective? How do you see to an operation if you're a division commander and you've got all these different pieces of your division everywhere? How does that work?
Well, that's where these task forces come in. So at Palawan, I believe it's the assistant division commander given charge of that, the 186th, the separate regimental combat team that is conducting the Palawan landings. But the division commander and his other two regimental combat teams are almost solely focused on Mindanao, while the other regiment and its task overarching task force are in charge of that. Now, and Bill, you probably could speak to this better than I can, but really, Army divisions aren't structured to have this split command structure necessarily.
Well, and that's why I'm curious about this, too. It's like you have a colonel of an infantry regiment.
Right.
He is he's used to commanding his organization plus assets. But he's got to have the right kind of, we joke about the mic check, right? You know, you're looking at the rank on your chest. Is this thing on? Just the authority to direct other assets and also the knowledge to direct other assets, because a general typically brings a staff along with them where you can do stuff. So are the colonels commanding every bit of these task forces a lot of the time, or in these cases where the division's kind of scattered out, is the general keeping control of all the afloat assets and he's the one doing it? Or is it the colonel owning everything like in that first case we could study?
Yeah, and that's what it really depends. if you have generally, if there is the assistant division commander, the brigadier general, they'll put him in charge of the entire task force, at least the ground task force, and then the regimental commander is then free to maneuver his regiment. Sometimes you don't have that, though. I'll bring up Corregidor. So there's no one star over the 503rd Parachute Infantry Regiment because it or regimental combat team because it's an independent regiment. They don't have an assistant division commander to pull from. So Colonel Jones, the regimental commander, is in charge of that entire task force for Corregidor. Now, he's not that far from any of the other assets he's going to need, so that helps him. But that task force has his three infantry regiments plus the 1st Battalion of the 34th Infantry Regiment that's doing the amphibious landing besides the parachute landing that the 503rd is doing, plus there, you know, there's a tank company, there's their engineers, all these other units on Corregidor. So.
And he owns the landing
craft. He does.
Which he is really, he owns. 6th Army really owns them. And because he's a bunch of separates, he's reporting straight up to General Kruger, who's the 6th Army commander.
Yes, exactly.
Let's talk about where these men are. So where is, I assume the colonel's on the ground with the RCT.
So, let's do Corregidor. So, it depends. But generally, the colonel's going to go ashore after the initial waves have gone on, and then once his command is established ashore, he then takes control of that operation.
Okay. But so he is the senior ranking officer on the ground?
If it's the colonel. If not, it's going to be the one-star assistant.
So where is the division commander?
Oftentimes, so for example, in Nassau Bay, the division commander was the 41st, while the 162nd is operating under the Australian command. He's hundreds of miles to the rear, or dozens of miles to the rear, with the rest of his division. So,
is he within radio contact range?
Not necessarily, and that was an issue at Nassau Bay when all their radios were flooded, so they didn't waterproof their radios.
So is there a core echelon here?
It depends if there is a core echelon. So like Bill was talking, I'll bring up Corregidor as another example. So Colonel Jones actually stayed in a command aircraft for the entirety of the jump and then jumped onto the island himself separately. So
who's in charge until he gets there on the ground?
So he would designate, it would have been one of the battalion commanders.
Okay.
So in these kind of fights, it's like he's got the ability, and this is something that we spent a lot of time talking about LISCO, is that when you're in tactics, the company and platoons, maybe even a battalion, we're used to our battalion commanders picking up a rifle, being in a tank saying, follow my move.
So they're going to run themselves.
Fighting the fight. Once you start hitting brigade, and certainly division and above, and in cases like these combined or joint task forces, the commander is where they can best overall control the situation.
So in this case, you said, so colonel's in the plane. Okay, where are the division corps commanders?
So this is where the 503rd is interesting. There's no division or corps over them because they're an independent regiment. So they're reporting directly to the 6th Army commander. There's some kind of administrative relationship with, I think, the 1st Corps on Bataan because the 34th Infantry Regiment of the 6th Infantry Division, I think it was, is involved in the operation because they're doing the landing. So he's got some kind of administrative, basically coordination with that headquarters. But for the vast majority of the operation, he's conducting that with going directly with the 6th Army headquarters.
And where is 6th Army headquarters?
It's on Luzon, probably about a few dozen miles to the north.
Okay, so it's not like back in Hawaii?
No.
Okay, so basically we have echelons up to Army relatively close.
Yes. Except, you know, for the persecution reckless. Yes, it's reckless. It's reckless in part because it's 200 miles behind Japanese lines. That amphibious operation. Obviously, that's going to has a big separation between.
So you kind of answered this question, Dr. Nance, but I do want to circle back to it to ask both of you. Is this a problem for people on the ground? Combat arms, engineers, logisticians, either to have this short, you know, echelons all the way up to Army within 20 miles, or maybe to have them not anywhere near you?
You want your commander where they can support you and bring the assets there. You don't need a commander typically over your shoulder telling you how to fight your insert echelon. We pay company commanders to fight companies.
Mm-hmm.
We pay battalion commanders to fight battalions, and they should be able to do so. What that next higher echelon is supposed to do is coordinate the pieces, the adjacent units. So I've got two battalion commanders. I'm not going to tell them how to do their jobs, but I'm going to make sure those two battalion commanders are coordinated. In the case of a joint task force like this, you also, as the overall command, have to make sure that all the other bits and pieces and bobs are in play. And you may not be the subject matter expert there, but you can pull on those individual people, and you're the one making sure it's all coming together. So it's not a problem that that dude's not necessarily like on the island with me. Like, take Corregidor is a good kind of case study. He needs to be where he can do his job, which in this case is talking to the Navy, talking to the Air Force, talking to a adjacent unit, the Corps that's on that's in Bataan. That's his job. That's mm-hmm. what he's there to do. And if he's not, and if he's on the ground with a rifle, his span of influence in some cases dropped to a couple feet.
So I'm reminded of a scene in Band of Brothers where Winters has been promoted. I think he's a battalion commander, and he's standing in a tree line watching his old unit attack a village next to the colonel, and he wants to go fight, and the colonel tells him no. Is this what you're talking about?
Partly, yeah. But the idea being is that's one company. He's got two others, at least. Maybe three, maybe some additional stuff. His job is not to go up and kick easy company in the butt and get them moving in Foy. His job is, well, okay, Major, what are you doing in terms of providing additional fires? Get tanks, whatever else may be the case. That's the job of, that's his job now. Mm-hmm. So if you notice, that's when he sends spears for, because I pay a lieutenant in this case to run that company. I'm paying a major to fight a larger fight.
So in this case, these kinds of operations can be very costly from the human perspective. What happens if that colonel watches his battalion commanders all get killed in this landing? Let's just assume it's a contested landing and a lot of them take casualties. What does that mean for the operation?
Well, maybe he does need to go forward. Not an amphibious operation, but just an operation in the theater. At Bunagona, or Buna specifically, General Eichelberger, who's the corps commander, is actually moving forward with platoons and making sure they're attacking the teeth of these Japanese defenses. So, you know, where you can best, like Bill said, influence these units, whether it's from an aircraft or not. Another example, so Palawan, but at this point, Eichelberger's the 8th Army commander, so he's commanding all of the ground units in the southern Philippines. During the Palawan landing, he is in his personal B-17, which I wish I had a personal B-17, but overflying the beachhead as they're seizing Palawan. So he's actually observing it from there. Why? Because this is the biggest operation going on that particular day.
So these guys have giant staffs, particularly once this guy gets to Corps and Army Command. What's the staff doing as this guy goes forward to command platoons?
So keeping the lights running, I guess, to use that term. So in this case, the 8th Army is probably planning the next operation, or the next three operations, because that's it.
Presumably not in the B-17.
No, probably not. Not enough staff.
What you'd see with is, in the World War II American Army, the Corps was a tactical headquarters, which is weird to say, but
yeah,
it is.
Very much confuses modern people, yeah.
Is, and so their job was the coordination of the divisions and all that stuff. So they had a G4, but he was in terms of coordination and allocation. So logistics and sustainment. And so while Eichelberger's forward with his army staff, the army's job is really where you see the combined and joint force really kind of come together a lot of the time. And so what they're doing is they're doing a lot of they're doing the actual logistics planning. They're doing all this stuff. He's giving them guidance and direction, and they're the ones telling the Navy, load this widget on this LST to get to this beach to give to this division. Mm-hmm. They're the ones doing all of that math after he's kind of given his distance and direction and all that kind of stuff. And again, he's where he can see the operation and then come back and tell his if an Army commander is doing his job right, he's going to come back, do his battlefield circulation, which is what we call it, and then come back and tell his staff to pull this lever, turn this knob, in order to make the overall operation flow.
the higher up they go, the less they should be focused on individual movement of organizations, because at that point in the game, we're literally paying other general officers to worry about that.
An example I've heard you use before has to do with how you write an operations order. Could you walk us through that, and as you go up the echelons, how that works?
Your paragraph, so paragraph three is the brass tacks. It's what you do. Paragraph four is the sustainment. The higher up you go, your paragraph three gets smaller because you have other people to worry about that. They, you know, you literally have other subordinates to do that. Paragraph four, which is your sustainment, starts out small at the company level because it's literally, hey, when's Chow coming to at the senior echelons? Paragraph four has to be very detailed because you are the one now giving that Chow. Mm-hmm. So on that note, when we talk about Eichelberger doing that, what is he doing other than overflying that sure. that beach? Is he actually doing his job, or is he out joyriding?
Well, see, he's observing it, and obviously if there are issues, he's going to be able to fix those issues with his command and control, right? He could call down the Navy, say, hey, this is a problem, we need to fix this, right? And then also he's not just joyriding, he's seeing how this operation proceeds so that the next operation he can bring guidance back to his staff and say, hey, they screwed this up on Palawan, let's try to fix this for next time, right? Or things like that. So
there are lots of amphibious operations in the Atlantic and Mediterranean, and I know you referenced John Curtola's book about them, which is recently out. Just briefly, how would you say the Pacific amphibious operations compare to those, particularly the big one most people are going to be familiar with, D-Day?
Right. So I would say it's scope and pace, right? So while in the Pacific, they do some large operations, right? The Lingayen landings on northern Luzon, I believe that's a four-division front, which is, you know, the Normandy landings are five-division, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty big, it's two corps, it's a pretty big landing. You also have, like I mentioned before, you have company, battalion, regiment, and regimental and division landings as well, and they're happening pretty quickly. That's one of the reasons why some of the units, they're doing it with smaller units because they don't have larger units necessarily. And they're doing them at unopposed places because if they were trying to attack an opposed place, they don't have the forces to do that. So it's really the pace and scale. So, you know, they're what, six, I would say, in the European theater, major ones? Yeah.
You got Torch, Sicily, Salerno, Anzio, just staying in the Mediterranean to be clean, Dragoon, and then you got Overlord.
Right,
yeah.
And then
Dieppe.
Dieppe was a you kind of have to, although right. Dieppe was a raid. It was a planned withdrawal that was pretty catastrophic, so... Seven, and then you can maybe count the Rhine, Jim. I don't know.
Right.
You can count the Rhine.
I probably would.
Yeah.
I've kind of looked into this to compare and contrast. So I've looked. So the Marines did a few regimental combat team landings. MRL is one of them, but not many compared to the Army. There are several smaller landings, as you probably recall, Bill, on Sicily, where Patton, in a couple of cases, is taking battalions to try to do an end run around the Germans. Does that work out well for him? I don't think so.
Yes, some no. Kind of depends on... It depends.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Some were actually very successful. Others were nearly catastrophic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So... All of this is kind of what you said earlier. It's these units facing situations that they hadn't necessarily trained for and maybe hadn't even been assembled for. You touched on this earlier, but I'd like to return to it. What would you say is a takeaway for a modern practitioner who's listening to this and wanting to know how this can inform warfighting in the present and future?
I think it's partially just staying informed, right? Clearly, some of these guys were just thrown into these positions. I'll give you the example of the NUMFOR staff. So that's the Cyclone Task Force is the overall task force, the 158th Regimental Combat Team is the ground unit, essentially. That staff, I looked through their records, the personnel officer, the logistics officer, most of them were on that staff, and the operation took a few weeks, but most of them were on that staff for a couple weeks to a month maybe, and then they changed out the task force, because it's not a, you know, it's a task force staff. It's not a Army organization organic, right? But they clearly understood the operation because there were no major logistical issues from what I saw. The maneuver was pretty good on the ground. So they'd clearly done some kind of self-study, or they'd gotten some good TTPs, tactics, techniques, and procedures from other folks. And they just had intellectually the wherewithal to understand that, well, what problems were in front of them and how to solve them, or just to sit there and solve them. So,
So, because one of the things that we've hit on, I've hit on a lot in my own research, is there isn't a good, like, we didn't necessarily cover every single doctrine or a military possibility that was out there, right? Okay. But the doctrinal processes they learned at staff schools seem to generally work. So all that schooling that we did during the 30s, when I've looked at Northwest Europe, it seemed to generally apply and keep this whole big green machine rumbling forward in the same general direction. Is that kind of what you're seeing here as well?
I would say that, and even if someone hadn't received formal schooling, I would say that there is enough expertise somewhere on the staff that had to have been shared at some, you know, level that we probably couldn't see in the records, for people to at least be able to execute their jobs and their duties.
So they hadn't specifically been trained on how to do amphibious operations, but they've been trained on how to do operations and could learn vicariously or through books or through just figuring it out.
Maybe at the chow hall.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it sounds like a takeaway from this is cultivating yourself and your knowledge and understanding is one of the keys to being good at transformation and contact. Is that correct?
Yes. And then templates are good. Like, obviously, there were a lot of pre-made things, especially later in the war, for some of these units to just fall in on. But beyond that, you have to understand, like we teach our historians, right? All circumstances are different, so you need to understand the specific circumstances of the operation you're undertaking as well.
All right, Dr. Villanueva, this has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.